WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio at FairToFlare.com. I'm Jason Mann, and today my guest again is Scott Bowden of Kentucky Fried Wrestling. Scott, how are you doing today?
Hey, it's good. And you actually said that right this time, Kentucky Fried Wrestling.
Exactly. Yes, yeah, Kentucky Fried Wrestling.
That southern twang there.
Yes, I don't quite do it as well as you do, but being a Yankee and all, but I try my best.
That's nothing to be proud of, my friend.
So today we're continuing the Starrcade main event series, and this one is a very interesting show. Starrcade 89, the main event is Ric Flair versus Sting, but the concept of the show is very different from normal shows. It's the Iron Man concept with four wrestlers and four tag teams all facing off against each other in kind of a round robin tournament, and the winners of each being crowned the Iron Man. I'm not sure what sort of awards you got for being the Iron Man. That was never made clear, but apparently it was a very prestigious honor.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess it was just bragging rights. Because I don't believe there was a, you know, in Memphis it used to trip me out because, you know, they would occasionally bring the CWA World Tag Team titles out of the closet, which I believe was one of promoter Eddie Marlin's bowling trophies. And the team would have to carry this huge trophy. I don't think anybody wanted to win that honor.
No.
So I'm not exactly sure. You know, and actually, in typical Turner fashion back in those days, typical WCW fashion, you know, when Tony Schiavone would scream, "We're running out of time. We'll have to see you next week." You know, during the presentation on the pay-per-view, the credits come up.
Yes.
You know, as they're making, you know, Sting and Flair hadn't even made it to the stage yet. So I'm not exactly sure what they got, what they were even fighting for, if they got, you know, it was never clear, like, what exactly does the winner get? Other than the title of Iron Man and Iron Team. Is there a trophy? Is there a plaque? You know, $100,000? Something, you know? Yeah. And you know, and I think it's ironic, too, before the show starts, they have, you know, it's supposed to be a tournament about endurance and stamina and athleticism. And who better than to go over the rules than the round mound of sound, Joe Pedicino, who breaks down the concept for us. Yes. A true Iron Man.
Indeed. So the singles competitors in here are Ric Flair, who is the World Heavyweight Champion, Sting, who does not have a title, Lex Luger, who is the United States Champion, and the Great Muda, who is the Television Champion. And Muda was undefeated before this show, but boy, did he not end up being undefeated at the end of it. He lost three matches here. Not a good night for him.
Talk about an incredible waste. You have... Gosh, I'm trying to think. At least a 7 or 8 month buildup with this wrestler, the Great Muda, doing moves that that most fans in the United States had never seen. You know, I'm sure, Jason, that you were probably one of many who, you know, maybe trading tapes back then and saw tapes of Japan. Or maybe you were just a big, huge. You were a big WWE mark.
Yeah, I was way too young for that. I was I barely watched NWA WCW at that point. I was pretty much all WWE was the only thing.
You were a big Hacksaw Jim Duggan fan, right?
I had some taste. Come on,
let's trade insults. Dog. Pillowcases.
I had the Junkyard Dog figure. I did have that. I'll confess to that. But you know, okay. I might have had the thumb guy.
This incredible buildup for Muda, who was almost getting he was almost getting a babyface reaction in some cases, just because of the huge pops for his moves. He had this air of mystery about him. You know, you had Gary Hart, who was a great talker. And I really think, you know, it seemed to be building towards something. You know, they were keeping him undefeated, which, and it was actually, you know, the way they did it, you know, unlike Goldberg Street, which, you know, half of it was fabricated. You know, they just kept inflating these numbers. Somehow I think he must have gotten 20 wins in 1 week. but this was like a legit slow build where they got the Great Muto over as being this unstoppable force.
Yeah.
And they just ruined it in one night. And it really could have been built. You know, I think the whole concept of this show was wrong. It's funny. I watched the show back recently on YouTube. And before it even started, I remember this is one of the first pay-per-view events I ever ordered. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, you know, just the idea of those guys wrestling each other appealed to me. You know, you had the Steiners versus the Road Warriors. But it just wasn't enough to sell it, I think, to a national audience. And even in Atlanta, I mean, such a hot wrestling town as Atlanta, I think the Omni was less than half full. And I remember that opening shot. I was like, man, look at all those empty seats.
Yeah, although Ross does cover that. Well, he says a lot of people are trying to get to their seats, apparently. So they're stuck in the gate, you know?
Well, yeah, Ross's credibility is also shot early on when he and Jim Cornette are speculating over the identities of the mysterious team known as Doom.
Yes.
Who could they be?
Yes, who could they possibly be?
I mean, everybody at home who's ever watched Mid-South Wrestling or WCW in the past, you know, anybody, you know, could pick those guys out.
Yes.
But Jim Ross and Jim Cornette, you know, Jim Ross has seen Hacksaw Butch Reed most of his career in Mid-South.
Who are those two men? Who are they? You know, yeah. It was quite a mystery. That was a baffling one.
Wait, almost as baffling as their theme music. The Team of Doom, and it's like this jazzy riff.
Yes. That was very strange. The whole thing was, I kind of think that if they had just made it the singles and gotten rid of the tag one, because obviously you had the, you know, the Road Warriors and the Steiners, that was obviously something people wanted to see. I guess you could have just really just done that match as kind of special, like.
That's actually on my card. You're stealing my booking ideas.
Okay, dude. Well, yeah, but I really, you know, now the Skyscrapers had a, they did have quite, you know, with Sid obviously having that presence. I mean, they were pretty over at that point, I guess. And they were a pretty dominant team. People kind of wanted to see them. And unfortunately, Sid was hurt. And then they had the Samoans kind of in there, who I think were pretty cold at that point, or were even pretty new to the promotion, if I'm not.
I think, yeah. And I think Sid, I think that was a softball injury.
Okay, nice. We got to have priorities.
I believe he tore his hamstring running to first base.
Okay. There you go. Yeah. And then Doom, you know, who later heated up pretty decently. I mean, they had a decent run like in 90 and maybe even in a 91 before Simmons, you know, became a singles and won the WCW title. But, you know, but at this point, they also were kind of, yeah, I think the masks didn't help anybody. They got rid of them pretty soon after this.
Yeah, I never understood the mask deal at all. And I think they lost them at the Clash in January.
Okay.
I believe they had to put the mask up against the Steiners for the belts. And boy, and just hearing Jim Ross feigning surprise, you know, like, oh my gosh.
I can't believe it.
Yeah, I can't believe it.
Shocking.
But you know, it goes to show you, I think, that even though that Ric Flair is probably the best wrestler in the world in 1989, that doesn't necessarily mean that he was the best booker. From what I understand, this was largely his concept, mm-hmm. and it sort of tied into their philosophy and their slogan at the time, the NWA We Wrestle.
Yeah.
Because the whole lore of this show is about, you know, seeing these matchups and getting a lot of actual wrestling for your money, which I think would have been fine perhaps for a TV special or something like that. But not on pay-per-view, especially not for Starrcade, which you know, for years had been built around, you know, these real deep grudge matches and personal issues. And I think it goes back to, you know, one thing that the Memphis promotion always prided itself on: personal issues for all money. Mm-hmm. Now, if you can have, you know, like in Starrcade 85, we discussed, you know, the main event was for the NWA title, Dusty and Flair, but that personal issue, you know, of Flair turning on Dusty in the cage, supposedly breaking his ankle, putting him on the shelf, Dusty coming back. You know, it was less about the title and more about, you know, Dusty getting his hands on Flair and getting revenge. Mm-hmm. And this show had none of that. It lacked a lot of soul. And it just it was really kind of a boring show. You know, the lack of heat in the main event, for the outcome of a Flair-Sting match, you know, the crowd's pretty dead, I thought.
Yeah, they were into it at the end, certainly, you know, as time was winding down. But yeah, I mean, it didn't have the same kind of fire that you really came to expect of, you know, WCW, NWO main events at this point. I mean, they were in Flair main events, certainly. I mean, you really, yeah, you expected just a, you know, really fiery, emotional crowd. And this definitely, you know, they were into it at points throughout the entire show, but you're right. It didn't have that same sense of emotion. I think this is a show that kind of was a setup show to the personal issue leading to, you know, in the end here, Sting beats Flair for the first time and sets up Sting as the number one contender, sets up the Horsemen eventually turning on Sting, and then Sting eventually triumphing over Flair and then in theory becoming the, you know, superstar of the 90s. But not exactly working out that way. But so it is strange for, I mean, I think you have to have set up shows obviously to build to the big shows. I mean, you can't have a big emotional thing every time. You have to obviously set up those stories, but it's very strange to have it be at what is theoretically your biggest show of the year.
Yeah. I thought it was just, you know, especially in hindsight, you know, looking back on it, you know, when I was younger, I greatly preferred the NWA and WC product, to the WWF at that time. So this was like, you know, for me personally, as a you know, I think I was 18 or 19 when this show was put together. Mm-hmm. You know, I was all for, you know, I was into it, but it just, you know, it didn't work on a local level. It couldn't, if you can't fill the Omni for Starcade,
yeah,
there's a problem there.
Absolutely. And I thought the show, I actually did watch the whole show, and I found it like watchable. I mean, I found the matches all were pretty interesting. I mean, I thought, you know, it was kind of neat to see the combinations, but yeah, as a big selling point, it definitely failed. And it was interesting watching this show because it's definitely bang, 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 match. I mean, there's no, like, you know, even like the, you know, WWE shows at the time, they would cut to interviews. They would do, at the WrestleManias, they would do wacky things with Bob Uecker and Mary Hart and Vanna White and stuff. Here,
you love that stuff, didn't you?
Oh, I'm a huge Bob Uecker fan. Let me tell you.
Well, on the flip side, though, while you're mentioning celebrities, boy, how country does Jim Ross sound in this?
Really, really country, yeah.
It sounds like he could be Roy Clark or Buck Owens walking you to another edition of Hee Haw.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh my gosh! They combined with Jim Cornette and Terry Funk.
Yeah.
Boy.
Yeah. I actually enjoyed Terry Funk as a commentator.
Oh, no, I love Terry Funk.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I never heard him before. But
we were talking about what could have possibly saved the Black Scorpion angle, and I mentioned Terry Funk, and you replied, "Terry Funk makes everything better."
Exactly. Yes, Terry Funk does make everything better. Yeah.
But you know what's strange about this is that we're less than. When this show took place, I believe it was just 6 weeks, 5 weeks after the most highly watched clash in history, mm-hmm. you know, which was for the Funk Flair I Quit blow off.
Yeah.
You know, so I kind of, you know, part of me thinks, gosh, you know, should they have waited to have the blow off for Starrcade? You know, they've been building this grudge feud. You know, it's hard to say, I mean, because clearly the interest was there on free TV. Mm-hmm. Now, would it have resulted in a sold out Omni? I think not. I think maybe they should have gone the direction of Flair versus Muda.
Yeah.
You know, now it would have taken some work because Muda can't cut a promo. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, at that clash, and again, this was still kind of, I don't think they didn't really do a lot at the clash to set up this concept of a tournament. You know, usually I think the clash was supposed to set up the pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. They didn't really do a lot of that. And a lot of guys who appeared on the clash weren't even on the pay-per-view. So, you know, but as part of that clash though, in November, Flair got the Wrestler of the Decade award.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I think in order for it not to come off as like a total sham and a total work, which it was, you know, they had Bill Apter from Pro Wrestling Illustrated, which of course is going to lend some credibility.
Sure.
You know, you know, Bill is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist.
Absolutely.
But, you know, maybe you could have had Flair's entire family there to receive this award. And had they not blown the wad early and had Muda blow the green mist on Missy Hyatt and totally waste it, maybe you could have had Muda blow the mist and, you know, Mrs. Flair and hits Mrs. Flair in the eyes, blinding her at Christmas.
Oh, wow.
You know, so therefore, then you have this personal issue. You know, you have the undefeated streak. Can Muda be beaten? Mm-hmm. You know, and then you have this great, you know, oh, I can't wait to get my hands on you. The fans can't wait to see me get my hands on you and avenge my wife, who can't even see her babies open up their Christmas presents. You know?
Yeah, I like that. That's pretty good. That's a real nice way of setting that up. And, you know, you can and yeah, that's really you know, I always enjoy Flair, like, fighting for something as a babyface. I mean, obviously he's awesome in pretty much any role that he has. And traditionally he's the villain, or at least the cocky guy. But, you know, it's something that when he brings his family into it, like those stories, because they're rare enough, they always work well on an emotional level.
Yeah, I mean, like, you look at Starrcade 83, and they had done such a great job. I think they had purposely put Bob Orton and Dick Slater in an interview segment, or at least Bob Orton in an interview segment, where they had Flair's kids out like a month before this happened. Mm-hmm. You know, and Orton's holding, I don't know if it's Reed, I guess it would have been Reed, and then he ends up turning on him as one of Harley Race's bounty hunters. And Flair, you know, when he comes out with the baseball bat after short, you know, he announces his retirement, he's got the neck brace on.
Right.
And he runs out with the baseball bat, chases him around. And, you know, when he's doing this crazed interview, he, you know, he's like saying, "You held my babies." And it was great.
Yeah.
You know? And I think they could have done something similar there, you know, with Muda blowing the mist. I even entertained the thought, maybe the mist doesn't hit his wife. Maybe it hits one of his kids.
That might have been a little much.
Well, hey, in Memphis, what they would have done, they would have had him blow the mist on the kids, and then they would have taken Mrs. Flair and shaved her head. And then they would have tarred and feathered Flair.
Yes.
And set him on fire.
Yeah, I don't think the words "too much" were in Memphis's vocabulary.
Right, right. Of course, you know, WCW earlier that year had Terry Funk trying to kill Ric Flair with a plastic bag.
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah. And okay, that leads me to something that I thought was strange. It wasn't during this match, but it was during the show where Jim Ross says something like he's never been more proud of anyone, any wrestler in any year than he was of Terry Funk.
No, right.
Who, like, 6 weeks before had been, you know, had you know, lost to Flair in the big blow off of their feud, and then Funk had sort of been, like, endorsed Flair after that, as far as, like, you know, okay, you're the better man, you know, that kind of thing. So he'd sort of turned at that point, but it was still, like, a weirdly out of place comment for all the, you know, all the shenanigans that Funk had done. As you know, he, you know, for people who don't know, after Flair's famous series with Steamboat, he wins the title back, and then immediately after, Terry Funk, who's one of the judges, comes to basically congratulate him and then sort of challenge him, and then Flair declines, basically just saying that Funk hadn't really fought any contenders in a while, that he needs to take it up with the committee and blah, 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 and then Funk attacks him from behind and pile drives him onto a table after, like, a, you know, 35-minute match. So, and then just leads into the great series they had during the summer. Lots of classic matches, and then of course the I Quit match we reference as the finale.
And if only Funk had been able to pull off that pile driver through the table like Randy Savage did to Ricky Morton in Memphis.
Yeah,
that could have made the angle so much better, because that looked like, I don't know how Ricky Morton survived that. The table wasn't gimmicked at all. So, and I was actually there live in the Coliseum that night. And I was just even for Memphis Wrestling, I was stunned. But I think two of the most famous phrases that Terry Funk's known for are the post empty arena bout with Lawler, where he, you know, his blood is streaming down his eye and he's screaming, "My eye." And also when he attacks Flair after Flair insulted him, or in his mind insulted him, and said, you know, "I'm not good enough." You said, "I'm not good enough." Oh man, I just I love Terry Funk. I could listen to Terry Funk read the phone book.
Yeah, he's outstanding.
Yeah, he's just crazy, and I think too he, you know, I don't. He even said afterward that when they did the, you know, that it was an I Quit match for the Clash, but that he didn't realize that they were kind of phasing him out. You know, he had been, you know, now it was hard for him to wrestle his style at that age, and not have, you know, he missed some matches, I think, for a 6-week period going into the pay-per-view shortly after the angle with Flair.
Okay.
With Sting, where he would attack Sting in the aisle. That way they could just kind of have a quick brawl and he wouldn't have to actually wrestle.
Okay.
And then I think he missed a Clash because I think he hurt his back. So obviously you couldn't count on him long term, but I think he was, you know, he didn't realize that he was actually quitting, you know, that he was actually quitting wrestling, you know,
right,
when he said, I quit. And I think they really missed out. I think it was too soon. You know, you're coming off this great buildup of Funk as this maniac, and then suddenly you make him this likable, charming announcer.
Sure.
6 weeks later, even though, I mean, you know, they handled it pretty well where he did take, you know, he did keep his word. He did shake Flair's hand and say he was the better man. Mm-hmm. But, man, going back to what the card that could have been, if you keep Funk as a heel, God, think of the bout, maybe under Texas deathmatch rules he could have had with Arn Anderson on that show.
That's an interesting one.
I got him. You know,
yeah.
That would have been a Starrcade worthy undercard co-main event, I think.
How do you get there with Arn? Obviously, Arn's fresh back from WWF of just wanting. Is there a way to get there as far as just he's he wants more? You know, Flair's done, but he wants more. Or is there another way to get to that direction?
Well, maybe again, like, you know, if they did the I Quit match, you know, maybe Funk, you know, gives up, says I quit, shakes Flair's hand, and then turns on him again.
And maybe leaves him
for dead after that.
Sure.
But I don't know. I'm not exactly sure how you get there, other than the fact that, you know, Flair and Funk have had this, you know, 6-month issue. He nearly broke the neck of his best friend, and you've got two of the best talkers in the business, Arn Anderson and Terry Funk. They can say anything,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to get people interested in their match.
Yeah, no question.
So I just thought of that. I didn't exactly figure out a way to get there, but those guys together could have figured out something.
Oh, definitely, definitely. You know, I kind of had the thought of Terry Funk and Sting, just because obviously you're kind of getting Sting ready to get to face Flair. Sting can beat, you know, can beat Funk, kind of get as the bridge to get there. But I agree. But that match, I mean, you could have found something interesting about that match, but that's not going to even come close to Funk Anderson at that point.
Well, I like the way you're thinking of building Sting up, and I think what would have been great is if they had given him a clean win over Luger.
Okay.
You know, and have him win the U.S. title, and
okay.
And then you still could have done the deal where the Horseman turned on him, because then the logic states, you know, the NWA, I think at the time they were doing like a weekly top 10, and the United States champion was always ranked number one.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, maybe you do a deal where, you know, before Starrcade, you know, they kind of close the show with him becoming a member of the Horsemen, but maybe you do that sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And then in an unforeseen circumstance, Sting wins the U.S. belt. So that makes him the number one contender. So he should get the shot. Well, we didn't plan on this.
Yeah.
you know what I mean? And so then it sort of makes it, you can still do that turn, and it's almost a little more logical, you know, because Sting and it's a match that we're heading into a pay-per-view where the next pay-per-view where Sting has not ever pinned Flair clean,
mm-hmm.
you know, and in this case, the Starrcade 89, the show ends with him pinning Flair. So we know he can already beat Flair.
Right.
Whereas the issue still would have been in doubt. You know, that's one thing, you know, I think that Memphis was smart, you know, in August of 82 when they brought Flair into the studio. Now, Flair had done this in several territories where he would come in and agree to a non-title match and end up getting pinned.
Mm-hmm.
And in Memphis they did it. And, you know, I'm just speculating, but I think Jerry Jarrett and Lawler did a deal, you know, where it goes into an overtime and Lawler hits his fist drop and Flair leaves the ring. and, you know, is counted out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the issue is kind of in doubt. You know, what would have happened had Flair not left? The issue, you know, Lawler clearly got the better of Flair. Flair turned tail and ran. But the issue was still in doubt. Can Lawler really pin him?
Sure.
You know, but anyway, that's just my idea. And getting back to I just thought of something about the finish to Flair and Sting in this match. It was the exact same finish that they had done with when Ricky Steamboat won the world title earlier that year, where Flair's doing the figure four. And my gosh, Sting cannot do a small package to save his life.
Yeah, he really had trouble with that.
Yeah, he doesn't hook that leg. And then they do the same finish when he finally beats Flair for the world title at the Great American Bash.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they did that finish a lot. Because Flair beat Steamboat with that finish too, didn't he? Or was it off of like it might have been off a body slam. And then... At Wrestle War, Nashville.
That's exactly right.
Right, yeah. Because that's the same finish that... where Steamboat beat Savage in WrestleMania 3, although it's Steamboat in this case, but So, yeah. Wow, it's how strange that so many matches have the same finish. It's almost like,
crazy. You think Flair would be looking for that inside cradle.
Exactly, yeah. You think he'd have come up with a defense for it at some
point. And all you got to do is you just got to hook that leg, you know? In both cases, it looked like Flair just kind of wrapped himself up.
Yeah, exactly.
Much like when he dropped the world title to Dusty Rhodes in Greensboro in the cage.
Right, yeah.
Weird. Oh, and how about you know, we have I think another wasted opportunity. You know, you have Sting and Luger, who, you know, both at the time, you know, there's this speculation who's going to be the man who is the NWA world champion of the 90s,
right?
You know, for the next decade, it's going to be one of these two guys.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I believe they're the first singles match on this card, and you know, just it's just anticlimactic. You know, there's really nothing at stake here except 20 points in this tournament for we don't know what they're competing for exactly.
Sure.
And you know, the time limits were 15 minutes, which I thought was good because most of the matches were pretty good pace. Poor Lex, you know, he stalls for about the first 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the 15-minute mark, I believe there's like 30 seconds, they make the 30-second call, and Luger's so blown up, you know, he and Sting are on the ring apron, and the finish is for Sting to clothesline Luger.
Yes.
Into the ring, they're both supposed to tumble in, and Luger's supposed to fall on top and grab the ropes and pin him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sting keeps clotheslining. Keeps clotheslining Luger.
Yeah.
And Luger's so blown up, he can't take the bump.
Right. And then he has to sort of awkwardly fall on top of him and then get his feet on the ropes. Or...
probably whispering in his ear, come on, you son of a bitch.
Yeah.
it's just a sloppy execution.
Yeah.
And Luger gets the cheap win. And, I don't know.
I will give it to Luger. I thought he did really well in the next two matches, and obviously, you know, when you're wrestling Flair, you're gonna have a good match. But I thought Luger did a nice job of like almost playing Flair in the Flair match of doing the heel stuff really well, and just just doing the little things that kind of got under people's skin during that match. And then coming a couple of matches later against Muda and then selling the knee and being a complete babyface in that match. I thought that was a really nice turnaround for a guy who doesn't really show a lot of those things.
Well, I was really impressed with the way he changed tights. You know, at first he's in green and then he's in red. I was really impressed with that.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
Honestly, I was thinking during this match, I'm like, you know, these would get really sweaty. I would want to change in between matches.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, some brilliant analysis going on here. You know, I will say this, though. It's a shame that Sting ended up getting hurt at the Clash because Luger was really – I think the only time I've ever really been interested in Lex Luger – was during this time period. Uh-huh. And this was fresh off his heel turn on Ricky Steamboat when he attacked him with the chair at the Clash over the summer. Mm-hmm. And just that smirk, you know, it was sort of teased that he was, I believe that he was turning heel. And then I think it finally culminated with him attacking Steamboat, who just sold these chair shots beautifully.
Yeah.
Nobody can sell like Ricky Steamboat.
No, absolutely.
Except maybe John Cena. He can sell more. But Luger was really coming into his own as a heel.
Yeah.
And I think what was happening was that he had Eddie Gilbert working with him.
Okay.
He had Jim Cornette probably maybe in his ear a little bit if he would listen. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, okay, what is it about? I think everybody in the dressing room, you know, I think a lot of people disliked Lex. I think he had a natural cocky arrogance. Mm-hmm. Why is this guy a babyface? And they turned him, and I thought he was really hitting his stride. Now, he was never a great wrestler, but no. He was really starting to have a presence and a grasp of psychology. And then, of course, when Sting got hurt, they were left with no main event for the pay-per-view, so they had to turn him back. They had to switch him back. And to me, he never had that same momentum again.
Yeah. Now, I will say that even though he wasn't much of a wrestler, he put forth the effort in these years. Like, his matches were, you know, he worked hard. You know, he kind of reminds me of the first few years of Cena, where Cena, you know, would always kind of put the effort there and would, you know, and it wasn't always great and graceful. And he had kind of the same, you know, he had the same strength, but sort of tendency to kind of stumble a little bit or to kind of not be fluid necessarily. But I do think that for the most part, when I see these matches looking back, like I feel like Luger was trying hard. And I feel like in these matches, he's smoother than he was in some of the 88 stuff, even in the Starrcade 88 main event. Like I feel like he had more of a fluidity here than I recall in previous times. So it seemed like he at least was getting better. And definitely in the character work and in, you know, being a good heel, he was really, you know, hitting his stride there as well.
Yeah. You know, they say, you know, some of the best gimmicks are just taking a guy's natural personality and turning it to volume. And for me as a character, I hate to even almost use that term, but as a personality, as a heel personality, I thought he was really fine in his way. And you're right. I mean, I think his work was solid. I mean, gosh, he had a really good match as a heel defending the U.S. title on one of the clashes against Tommy Rich.
Oh, yeah.
And they had Jim Cornette, bless his heart. Just really selling. You know, I don't know how it came across live because he didn't have Cornette's call, but Cornette was just really recalling Tommy Rich's glory days, mm-hmm. you know, as the darling of TBS. And, you know, this is his one last chance to regain that glory. And he and Luger had this great match.
Yeah, he had a good match with Dan Spivey, too.
Yeah, which is not easy to do.
Yeah.
But why don't we go over? Why don't we go over our proposed cards?
Okay.
In place of this, in place of this tournament deal.
Sure.
Now I had, of course, the main event, world title versus the Street.
Okay.
You know, and maybe you know you have Gary Hart and Muda's corner, Ole and Flair's corner, mm-hmm. And maybe. You know, maybe the bandaged eyes of Beth Flair, you know, at ringside. You know, maybe her kids are leading her to the ring, you know, because she can't see. You know, there's this, you know, this great drama.
Yeah.
And after, you know, after this attack, I would have where you know, Flair had not been able to even remotely touch Muda.
Okay.
You know, up until this point. And just, you know, and it's no time limit, no disqualification. And you know, maybe give them, you know, 35, 40 minutes and have Flair win in the end.
Okay.
And he, you know, and he celebrates with, he's crying, you know, Flair's going to cry. Flair's crying. His maybe his wife even takes off the bandages and she can see.
It's a miracle.
Yeah, it's a Christmas miracle.
You know? I like it.
But yeah, Flair's family in the ring. You have Ole and Arn in the ring, and maybe Sting is in there as well. And you know, just this emotional celebration, you know, of good over evil. And then maybe for the World Tag Team titles, I'm kind of split. I'll listen to what you might think. You know, let's say if I guess it would have been ideal if Sid hadn't been hurt. but the Skyscrapers versus the Road Warriors for the World Tag Titles, or the Steiners versus the Road Warriors, build it up as a dream match. And it, you know, the heel turn for the Road Warriors, I believe they turned heel in 88, in mm-hmm. fall of 88.
Yeah.
They wrestled Sting and Dusty at Starrcade 88.
Yeah.
And then by 89, it was sort of like the switch was never really. It was never really explained, but suddenly they were kind of booked against the Varsity Club and started being, you know, they, I guess the fans never stopped cheering them, so they didn't quite know what to do with them.
Yeah.
But maybe if they, you know, maybe if they had kept the road, maybe if they had kept the Warriors heel, you know, because I think if you put them in the Steiners versus, I just remember so over at that point, you know, even in this tournament. The fans are just pumping for those suplexes.
Absolutely.
You know, every time they get Doom or one of the Samoans, you know, the crowd's just going crazy. The Steiners are so over at this point. So if there's anybody who they could have paired against the Road Warriors, maybe helped them keep their heel edge, it would have been the Steiners.
Yeah, I don't know if realistically you can keep the Warriors heel that long, because I think really it kind of fell flat and it probably wasn't going to keep there. So I think it can work as babyface versus babyface, and the Road Warriors kind of having that edge a little bit of, you know, like, you know, we're not going to play nice, we're going to be rough, we're going to, you know, and you can have some kind of face-to-face confrontations, you know, ahead of time just to kind of, you know, get the steam build in, but you're not really going to get a huge heat thing. I think it's more just it's more like, you know, the top two teams that have never faced off, kind of first time ever,
yeah,
type thing.
Yeah, I think like a Super Bowl, like a dream match.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you kind of have, you know, the team of the 80s versus possibly the team of the 90s thing here too. You know? Even though the Road War, you know, Flair was. Not that people were calling, not that they were portraying Flair as old, but Flair looked older than the Road Warriors looked, you know, physically.
Well, I don't know, because also struck me as funny, because I believe at this point, you know, there was starting to be some talk of how great like Shawn Michaels was, and it almost looked like Flair was trying to out mullet anybody in wrestling at this point.
Yes, that was pretty glorious at that point. Yeah,
yeah, I think Lawler got a pretty great mullet going around 1990.
That's true. Yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah. Oh, I don't. Yeah.
Inexplicable.
America was awash with mullets in the, you know, like from 89 to 91 or 92 or so. In wrestling, it was like till 95 or 96. But
yeah, and the mullet was big and was over big in 89.
It was huge.
I think Flair maybe thought it made him look younger or something.
Maybe, but it did not work. No.
But okay, and then I would have had, as we talked about, Lex Luger versus Sting for the U.S. title.
Okay.
Elevating Sting up to that number one contender position.
Yeah.
You know, we mentioned the absence of the Midnight Express. I don't know what you have in mind for them, but they ended up later that year, or in 1990, having some off-the-chart matches with Brian Pillman and Tom Zink.
Okay.
So, you know, Stargate always, you know, like, you have the big emotional grudge match, streak against the world title as your main event, the dream tag match, the clash of the stars of the 90s with Luger and Sting. And then you just have a solid kick-ass wrestling match right in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Midnight Express versus Brian Pillman and Tom Zink. Give them about 20 minutes, and they probably, who knows, maybe they tear the house down.
Yeah, I could see that kind of being like the Southern Boys Midnight Express match.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that was, I think, 1990. Yeah, I could definitely see that being. I mean, Pillman obviously was great. I think Zink was pretty underrated, you know, at least, you know, in the ring. He certainly had some pretty fun times. So I think that was good. I also, now, were the Midnight Express, were they heel at this point again, or were they still yet to turn on Dynamic Dudes?
I think they had the issue, and they were kind of like, they were starting to turn heel before the clash in November, and then okay. Cornette turned heel. You know, because he was supposed to be mentoring the Dynamic Dudes, and then he ended up nailing.
Okay.
I believe it was Douglas. Although
yeah.
In hindsight, I wish it had been Johnny Ace.
I don't know. I'm still thinking that Douglas is higher on the obnoxious scale than Johnny Ace.
I don't know.
But we may, you know, we might get there.
I think Douglas soon. Could talk, sort of.
That's true.
Oh boy. But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you could. People weren't behind the dynamic dudes, but I guess that's an option.
But the Midnight Express, they were definitely heels at that point. Okay. I think you could have had, and I believe, I don't know, I think they had a United States tag team title floating around.
Sure.
And that would have been a great undercard match.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure exactly when he signed, because I know that he was, I believe he was working Memphis and Dallas earlier that year. But I know in January, Cactus Jack was wrestling on the Clash of the Champions.
Okay.
Maybe bring him in a little sooner. Maybe he's already signed and they didn't use him. I'm not quite clear on that.
He's listed here. I have a roster for December 89, and Cactus is listed here. So.
Okay, so maybe Cactus Jack versus Kevin Sullivan.
Okay.
That was just kind of off the top of my head.
Yeah.
And I already mentioned the Texas Death Match with Arn Anderson and Terry Funk.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, it's kind of hard though. It's like, where do you put that match? Because that's going to be a knockdown, drag out. I'm not sure if they had banned blood. I know at one period they had banned blood on TBS, mm-hmm. And maybe on pay per view as well. So I'm not sure how you would have done a Texas Death Match with Terry Funk without having blood.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe something with because the Freebirds. Were hometown boys in Atlanta, maybe do something with them with Doom, versus the Samoans. I think, or maybe even split up Hayes and Garvin. It seemed like the Freebirds were really stale at that point.
Yeah, it felt like it was the end for them for sure.
Yeah, but I don't know. I just think that would have been, a lot bigger draw. Because you would have had so many issues, and just think of the buildup you could have had. We talked about Flair and Muda, but just think of the possibilities you could have had. The standoffs, maybe something happening with the Steiners and the Warriors, the angles that maybe they could have done. The natural jealousy, that would have occurred between two guys vying to be the wrestler of the '90s, between Sting and Luger. All these great things that they could have done to build up to this, and mm-hmm. Just sort of wasted.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it really does. Like, you were certainly promised some intriguing first-time matches, with this concept, with the Iron Man concept, which is kind of the reason why I'm more okay with it than you are, although I certainly concede, your points on it. But it definitely... there was nothing going into it that led to that much excitement. I mean, it was like, okay, we're promising you these matches, but there was nothing to like focus like, oh, what's it going to be like when the Steiners and the Road Warriors first hit? What's it going to be like when, Luger gets his chance to fight Flair again for the first time in a year, or, Sting for the first time since Clash of the Champions, his great time limit draw, all that stuff.
But what are the stakes?
Yeah.
I think that's the main thing that's missing from the show. Mm-hmm. What's at stake?
Yeah.
What issues are going to be resolved? Mm-hmm. It does sort of have that element of, the traditional wrestling booking. You have this guy or this team, and they're on their way up, and this other team is going, and what's going to happen when they wrestle? That is one element that this show had, because it's like, oh my gosh, you're going to see the Road Warriors and the Steiners, you're going to see Flair and Muda, but it just, the stakes weren't high enough for me.
Yeah.
Other than the intrigue of seeing them collide, I just think they could have done a better job of the buildup. And I think they really kind of boxed themselves in with this tournament. And I think it also hurt the finishes as well. Not only did, in my scenario, Flair would have indeed beaten Muda, and he would have lost his undefeated streak, but they would have gone like 35, 40 minutes.
Right.
And it would have been, and it would have been one loss. And,
right.
And Muda would have, had Flair on the ropes. You would have had Flair about down and out, and he rallies for the win. I even like the finish, with Flair getting his knees up off the moonsault and doing the inside cradle for the, doing the small package for the 1-2-3.
Sure.
I think that finish would have worked. But gosh, you build up this guy for 7 months, undefeated, legit undefeated, has won every match on TV, and you beat him in, what, 3 minutes?
Yeah.
Which is unbelievable. Yeah. Then he does a clean job for Sting. You know, and that, gosh, and think of the build. You know, that could have been a dream match too. Sting, you know, these two superheroes, Muda and Sting. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe that could have been a match on this card as well. You know, Sting and Muda colliding.
Yeah, and Sting getting his revenge for Muda beating him for the TV title, which was the big, which is kind of Muda's first big signature win. You know,
right.
So yeah, I
a number of ways they could have gone. You know, and Muda was, you know, he was never quite the same after that. I think the aura of Muda was ruined with this show.
Yeah.
I
think he was on his way out.
Yeah, I think he was pretty much finished after the clash where Sting got hurt.
Yeah, because Arn beats him for the TV title pretty much right after this. Yep. And then, you know, he's pretty much done after that. So, yeah, I get that he was on his way out and that, you know, they didn't they obviously didn't feel like protecting him at that point. But, yeah, there was a better way. You could have gotten a lot more mileage out of the first loss and, you know, and let it really be something meaningful instead of just having it be, you know, three losses to, you know, on this show that didn't have a whole lot of meaning.
And Gary Hart wrote in his book, which is one of the better wrestling books out there, mm-hmm. You know, how embarrassed Muda was because the Japanese press was there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he had been getting all this acclaim because he had been this undefeated superstar in the United States, and here he loses three times in the same night. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, again, they really box themselves in with these finishes because mm-hmm. you know everything sort of had to kind of even out a little bit. Like Luger gets the cheap pin, but Sting ends up winning the tournament. The finish to the Steiner's Road Warriors match. How lame was that?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I believe they do the Animal does the back suplex and Scott gets the shoulder up. Mm-hmm. That's just not the kind of finish I want to see between those two guys.
Right.
You know, that's a Jack Briscoe, Dory Funk Jr.
Exactly. Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
It was such a cheap way out.
Yeah. You want like a like lots of zany power moves, lots of kickouts, that's too scientific for, you know, what we, and obviously we've seen that finish 1,000 times too. I mean,
and then because of the pairings, you know, we're stuck with the Samoans versus Doom match.
Right.
You know, I think everybody went to the concession stand at that point.
Yeah.
I don't know if Jim Ross pointed that out.
I don't think so. No, I don't think he emphasized that quite as much. Yeah.
Oh gosh.
Exactly.
But yeah, you know, it's a card that, I mean, it actually has a lot of good action, and the work is solid, and we get to see Tyler Mane as Woman's Bodyguard.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just. Very exciting.
Yeah.
And boy, Woman was pretty hot at that point.
She was. She was indeed. Yeah.
Is it wrong to talk about that somebody who's deceased like that?
I don't think so. No. You know.
Time has gone by.
Yeah. I think it's too soon. Absolutely.
Nancy Benoit was.
Yeah. She was quite a looker. No question about it.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty much on board with where you're going for as far as the show goes. I was thinking something I kind of think Cactus Jack and Tommy Rich would have been interesting. I know Rich didn't mean much at this point, but I kind of think that could have been a zany thing, or even actually Cactus and Eddie Gilbert. You know, they of course had quite a feud later in the 90s, kind of the pre-ECW days, in the Philadelphia indies.
That part of Eddie Gilbert's run, I don't get at all. I think what happened, I think Eddie had lost his booking power.
Okay.
And Flair was pretty much in charge at that point. And I don't think Rick looked at Eddie as a star.
Okay.
And why in the world, you know, Eddie's this guy who just, he can be an incredible heel, you know, and he's in tag matches with Tommy Rich. Mm-hmm. And they sort of teased at one point this rivalry between he and Pillman,
where
they had two matches on TV, on TBS, and Pillman just kind of outfoxed him, didn't necessarily out-wrestle him, but just kind of outsmarted him two times in a row, and Eddie got increasingly frustrated, and it looked like they were going to go full-blown heel turn, and then Eddie just up and left. Eddie claimed he had an injury.
Ah, okay.
And then a week later, he was wrestling in Memphis. So I think he faked an injury and they let him out of his contract. And then like 2 weeks later, he was back in Memphis throwing a fireball at Lawler's face.
Okay.
Because I think Eddie was just like, you know, he would rather be the big fish in the small pond and do his thing and be a heel than be in the opening match tag teaming with you know, Tommy Rich. But, you know, I was even thinking for this card, maybe you could have had, you know, Gilbert and Rich have their falling out like they did in Memphis as the new Fabulous Ones.
Okay.
You know, that could have been a nice undercard match.
Yeah, that could have been a fun old school Southern thing. You know, I definitely could have dug that.
Yeah, and it just, you know, Eddie was such a tremendous heel. I have no idea why. You know, he wasn't even on the show.
Yeah.
So much, and that's the biggest, I think that's the biggest drawback to this show. And the fact that they only drew 6,000 people to the Omni for this show. So much talent was missing, just sitting at home. And gosh, it had to be a bummer for the boys themselves, because they probably earned the same pay.
Right.
You know, probably, or around the same pay that they would have gotten anyway, and they had to go out there and work three times.
Sure, sure, exactly. Yeah. I was kind of thinking that we don't really have, like, the Varsity Club on the show. And I don't know if the Varsity Club were still together or I mean, they're all – Rotundo, Sullivan, and Steve Williams are all on the roster. We think maybe Williams might have been in Japan at this point. But I kind of think maybe I think the Varsity Club and the Samoans might have been kind of a good, you know, especially if you have Williams there, kind of a Haas versus Haas type thing. Mm-hmm. Although I guess both would be heels, so that might not work out. So
I love the Varsity Club gimmick, though.
That was great. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
I didn't necessarily understand Sullivan's.
Yes, that was always true.
You know, you have the guys in the letterman's jacket, and then you have Sullivan in his wizard outfit. But other than that, I thought that was a pretty solid gimmick.
Uh-huh. But I mean, I think we've been pretty clear. You know, we certainly have some good potential ideas of what they could have done with, you know, with this pretty incredible roster of that. At least, you know, of Worker, certainly. You know, just guys who could go out there and really have some, you know, fabulous matches. And
it's really bizarre for me to believe that Flair, you know, this guy who, you know, the Mid-Atlantic deal. You know, when Flair regained the world title at Starrcade 83. You know, there really was. It wasn't just Flair going out for the belt. You know, the Flair for the gold. Mm-hmm. They had done this deal where Harley had put a bounty on him. You know, not only, and I don't know if it was done intentionally, but you know, he didn't even say to any wrestler. He said to anybody. Which I can't believe that some redneck in North Carolina did go to Flair's house with a shotgun.
Oh God!
To collect $25,000?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Which is more than most people see in their lifetime in North Carolina. But, I think because, you know, Triple H, when he was world champion, he did the same deal where he had the belt and the briefcase of money.
Yeah, for Goldberg, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, you know, it's open to anybody. And then I think he had to come back the next week on Raw and say to any, you know, to any super, I don't know if he said any wrestler, probably any superstar.
Right.
Or sports entertainer. That sounds a little less threatening, but
yes.
But I think they had to stress that three times in the broadcast that it was that the bounty on Goldberg was not open to just anybody.
Yes, that could create some unfortunate situations for sure.
Right. Well, you know, if you did that right now, especially in these economic times.
Yeah, you know.
Really.
Listen, if somebody put a bounty on Triple H, I might think about it.
If somebody put one on Laurinaitis, then, or, you know, if somebody put one on Johnny Ace right now, I might try to collect it.
Oh, man, I don't think Johnny Ace is all. I mean, I don't think he's that bad. Not compared to Triple. I mean, Triple H is just being the focus of the show again. I guess is the thing. The performance isn't that bad, but you know, Johnny Ace. I don't know.
Can I curse on this podcast?
You can. Yes.
Okay. You know, when I was watching that beginning of Raw the other night, I swear I was reminded of the opening to Pulp Fiction. You know, with Amanda Plummer robbing the coffee shop. Uh-huh. You know, I felt like anybody with Triple H was going to say, if any of you motherfuckers move all pedigree of a motherfucking list one up here.
Oh, God.
Or if you're, you know, if you guys don't get your asses back out here, I'll pedigree every motherfucking last one of you. Yeah. Just a total, typical Triple H burying the roster.
It was
Jesus.
Yeah,
it was so unbelievably bad. I think I linked or I retweeted. I believe one of your colleagues from the Kickout blog wrote a tremendous write up and who's the guy who writes that?
Razor.
Yeah, it was so spot on.
Yeah.
Props to him because it just pinpointed exactly why that angle is wrong, especially for these times.
Yeah.
And just completely out of place and just how out of touch Triple H and Vince McMahon truly are in a lot of ways with today's audience.
Yeah, it's pretty. That was a pretty just tone deaf tenure, whatever you want to put it, on just so many levels of I mean, obviously signs of the times, of basic storytelling, of basically making almost every single character on your show look dumb, and just so many things. It's kind of baffling.
Solidifying Sting's reputation as a corporate kiss ass.
Right.
Anyway,
yeah.
All right, Jake.
Yeah. Okay. One thing I want to ask, we'll talk a little bit about the actual match since we've been on this for that long without actually getting into it. But the NWA WCW thing. Now, obviously, Turner bought the Jim Crockett Promotions in late 88. They started incorporating the WCW name in 89. But I've always sort of wondered, I don't know if you have any memories of like how that was explained on television or if they... Because eventually, by 91, everything was WCW. They were calling all the belts WCW belts. I'm not sure how they handled the explaining the NWA title thing, because...
They really didn't, if I recall correctly. I think it's just they just started slowly phasing it out. I mean, I know it was still... I think Sting was the last... NWA World Champion.
Right.
When they were still calling it that. And then when he lost it to Flair, you know, he won it, I believe, in June of 90.
Yeah.
At the Great American Bash with that same finish from Starrcade 89.
Right.
And which he still didn't really hook the leg. and he was referred to the NWA World Champion. And then by the time he dropped the belt back to Flair in January at the Meadowlands, they were calling Flair the WCW champion.
Right.
My memory serves me correct. And I think it was just, I think they just slowly just started kind of phasing it out. And there really wasn't an explanation. Because really, what could you say?
Right.
Because I think it had just gotten to the point that the NW promoters were disgruntled. And I felt that like they had no say in who the champion was or something like that. I'm not exactly sure. And that part's always been really muddled to me, but
and then obviously the NWA ended up leaving once Flair left for for WWE in that summer of 91. So at that point it kind of became clear, you know, at least that they were different titles and all that, but for a while it wasn't clear that the WCW title and the NWA title were two different things.
Right. And then it became even more confusing when Bill Watts came back, cuz he was trying to tie that NWA lineage back in, and
that seemed like a baffling decision in retrospect. But not that a lot of the Bill Watts stuff was baffling, although a lot of it was entertaining, and I kind of get in theory what they were trying to do. But
I mean, like that NWA World Tag Tournament was certainly ambitious.
Yeah,
to do it. I mean, they were actually trying to do a legit World Tag Team. You know, even though they had I think there was a tag team in Los Angeles back in the 70s called the Twin Devils. These two Mexican twins. And so, you know, they announced the Twin Devils from Mexico, and everyone was speculating, God, did they dig those guys up? And then, of course, it's like your typical TBS studio jobbers, you know, like the solid red body suits.
Right.
You know, who are supposedly Hispanic, but I don't know. But at least they tried. You know, they brought in Chris Benoit and
that's right, yeah,
Wellington. And,
right, yeah. There were some good matches in that tournament.
Very, very ambitious effort.
Yes, for sure.
And it seemed like they were going somewhere with Terry Gordy and Steve Williams versus the Shiners, but you never really got the payoff there.
Yeah. Anyway, back to the match. I mean, this is pretty standard Flair Sting, I would say. I mean, you really, after their first match, they certainly had some good ones, but I can't really recall another great Flair Sting match besides their first one. I mean, I don't know if there's any that stand out to you as being just like mind blowing, but to me, pretty much the first one is the one that's the absolute essential.
Yeah, and to be honest, they were pretty much the same, you know. And I think that's why their matches don't necessarily stand out. You could say that about a lot of Flair matches, I suppose.
Yeah.
But especially with Sting, it was somewhat limited. And I don't think Sting was ever really quite the same after he hurt his knee. Mm-hmm. You know, he seemed to be more of a high flyer. He was certainly taking more chances.
That's true.
And some people have even said that Lawler wasn't quite the same. You know, Lawler broke his leg. You know, Lawler was in 1979 was a heel, really at the top of his game. You know, mm-hmm. as a personality, mm-hmm. and you know, broke his leg in January 1980 playing touch football. And when he came back from came back with this great tailor-made feud because Jimmy Hart went on TV and, you know, said, you know, what do you do with, you have a prize racehorse, a champion, and he breaks his leg, you shoot him, which really legitimately angered Jerry Lawler. Mm-hmm. I mean, so he had this great feud already set up. But as a performer, a lot of people say that Jerry was never quite the same because Jerry was he was an incredible bump taker. Mm-hmm. You know, and just but they say the quality of it. Some people say, I don't really think he lost much of a step, but I've heard others say that. And you look back on it, and he probably really did work a more physical. I think he relied more on psychology.
Yeah.
When he came back from the broken leg, but yeah. You know, and again, I think that's one reason why Lawler's had the career that he's had.
Right.
You know, I think we even talked about at one point he and Miz put together one of the most exciting, thrilling ladder matches with only one, really one bump that was kind of like, I think Lawler took a bump halfway off the ladder, mm-hmm. you know, and it was still psychologically, it worked because of him.
Yeah.
And he was coming off a staph infection.
Right. Yeah.
And he still has this thrilling ladder match that the people believed in. Mm-hmm. But again, we're getting kind of off course. You know, all roads lead to Memphis for me.
They definitely do. They definitely do. Well, the notable stuff, I guess, is it's sort of, you know, because Flair's been a babyface for most of 89. So going into here, he's not quite the heel, but he's definitely playing it, you know, a little bit throughout, you know, some of the stalling, some of the other Flair, you know, trademarks. And we have, you know, and you're right. Yeah. I hadn't thought about it, but you do see Sting doing, quite a few leapfrogs, quite a few kind of jumping around more than, you know, he was always a pretty athletic guy, but I hadn't thought about it before, but you're right. It does seem like he, after 90, that was reduced, you know, at least somewhat. And obviously as he's aged, that's been reduced more, but certainly, you know, yeah, it's, you've basically seen one Flair Sting match, you know, pretty much you've seen them all, and it's good stuff. I think the 15 minute time limit works pretty well here with, you know, Sting, the issue is here that Sting has to win this match by pinfall or submission in order to win this Iron Man thing, and Flair could win by count out, and then if this is a draw, then Luger wins the whole thing. So, and then of course they're playing into the fact that the Sting Flair, the first match was a draw, so thinking right. that this could be it as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know, not bad storytelling, really. That's just my biggest problem with it. And I thought, really, I mean, talk about a hard task to come up with the finishes for all these matches.
Yeah.
And I thought, considering the limitations, that they did a pretty good job. Mm-hmm. But the finishes, by and large, were not satisfying.
Yeah.
You know, other than the fact that Sting finally got his clean win, you know, and I kind of wonder a little bit, you know, when they had that first 45 minute draw, and it was up against, was it WrestleMania 4?
Four, yeah, four.
Yeah, which was an awful show.
Well, and, it now, well.
Oh, no. I forgot who I'm talking to.
See, I had WrestleMania 4 on a VHS tape. It was the first.
Speaking of lame tournaments,
it was the first one that I ever watched as it happened. I had it on tape, and I watched it dozens and dozens of times as a child. So I have a very special place in my heart for WrestleMania 4.
So
but
you like so you like boring tournaments?
I love boring tournaments.
See, I think
yes.
Tournaments are great for amateur wrestling.
Well, tournaments are good tournaments are good stories to lead to good stories.
Right.
They're a good beginning of a story. Is
I kind of okay, but
anyway,
we'll say why don't we'll break down WrestleMania 4 and why it didn't work next time.
That's probably a good idea.
I wonder though, because you know that clash drew such huge numbers and Sting was so hot. Mm-hmm. And it always seemed to me like one of the things that really limited Jim Crockett Promotions and later WCW and NWA and the Turner Group, you know, they were always just so scared to pull the trigger, mm-hmm. you know, on things. And just what if, you know, you had that first match, you have so many people watching Sting have this incredible match with Flair. Now, Flair's carrying him, but Sting's over like crazy at this point. He's young. WCW or the NWA, you know, lacks a Hulk Hogan. They lack a hero. You know, they're trying to compete with WWF. They have this heel champion who always cheats to win. He never gets a clean pinfall.
Yeah.
Man, what if, you know, they had done it where they had Sting, Rap Flair, and the Scorpion Deathlock. The time limit's running out. And just right before it's going to run out, Flair just can't stand it anymore. Sting cinches back, and Flair gives up. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, I kind of wonder what that would have done for, you know, and you could say, well, the you know Sting's chase for the world title is over before it begins and all that, and maybe that's true.
Yeah,
but I just sort of wonder. You know, think about it with Vince McMahon and Hulk Hogan, brought him in, and right away he just takes the title from the Sheik and he's off and running and he has this crazy momentum.
Yeah,
you know, and what if they had the guts to do the same with Sting?
You right.
know, at the time, I think before the Funk match, it was the highest rated, I think more people had watched a match. Never before had so many people seen a match on TBS as that Flair Sting main event. And the audience, I think the audience grew that afternoon. Mm-hmm. And on the same day as WrestleMania 4, you know, the NWA crowns its new young champion.
Yeah.
I wonder what would have happened. I wonder how hot Sting would have been. Maybe it would have been too soon. I don't know. But I've always kind of wondered if they had gone with that finish.
That's interesting. I mean, I think there's something to that because especially, you know, Hogan never chased. I mean, he did later, I guess. But the idea, the philosophy that worked for WWF for, you know, 40 years was – you know, you have your good guy champion and you build up dragons for him to slay.
Yeah.
And kind of the theory in the old school theory in wrestling is that the chase is you know, the money thing. But the, you know, kind of the most successful promotion in, you know, and throughout that time, even the territory days, New York was certainly, you know, if not the big money thing, then among the big money things. And part of that was market, certainly. But, you know, Bruno drew and, you know, other guys drew, and they drew based on that philosophy of having, you know, the dominant good guy. And they sent the Fantôme happy a lot. And, you know, I think that can work, too, if done right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the practice of the heel world champion cheating his way to victory or never quite getting a clean win, I think that was great for the territory days.
Right.
But not for national promotion.
Exactly. Yeah, I think
the NWA and WCW were just slow to change and slow to embrace that idea.
Right, and I think it could have been different if they would have gotten behind a guy, you know, a Sting or even a Luger. You know, I mean, if they'd done it at Starrcade 88 with Luger, I always a thing for me. That was kind of like. When I was a WWF fan, it's like, well, in the NWA, Flair and the bad guys always win. What fun is that to watch?
Yeah.
So. You know. Yeah. All right. Well, Tell everyone a little bit about Kentucky Fried Wrestling. Most people probably know, but give them the summary anyway if this is the first time they've heard of you.
I hope not.
Probably not, but you never know. Give anyway, pitch anyway. Well, sell them on your website.
I was a manager in Memphis. I really wasn't in the business that long. It was a short period of time, but it was certainly memorable, at least for me, because I was a longtime fan. I grew up watching Memphis wrestling. My hero, you know, was Jerry Lawler and Handsome Jimmy Valiant, growing up, two role models if there ever were. And, you know, I lived and died with my heroes every Saturday morning and Monday night. And then, you know, eventually got into the business as a referee and later as a heel manager, thanks to the late, great Eddie Gilbert. And I write about those experiences and also kind of, you know, comment on today's product and the psychology or lack thereof. And really kind of I like to look back at past Memphis history and kind of give you the inside details that we weren't, you know, privileged to have back in those days. You know, we always wanted to know the backstory to these wonderful, great angles. And I try to do that at KentuckyFriedWrestling.com. And actually, I have a review up right now of Memphis Heat, the great documentary that just came out earlier this year. And I just found out today that I'll be presenting that film. I'll be hosting a screening at Hollywood on October 30th at the Second City Theater on Hollywood Boulevard.
Oh, wow. Well, that sounds neat. Cool. Yeah. All right. Well, everyone, of course, check that out. And you can find us at fairtoflare.com and wrestlespective.com. We'll keep on with more podcasts and more writing. I think one of my colleagues is actually going to be submitting a review for Memphis Heat, so it'll be interesting to get his take on that. I know he doesn't know much about Memphis territory, so.
But if he knocks it, I'm gonna come after.
I'm pretty sure he liked it. I think he called it the best wrestling documentary he'd ever seen. To me,
yeah,
so.
I was actually relieved. Actually, I felt a little sick to my stomach because I was hoping that they nailed it, and I thought they did a great job. Maybe the only knock, they tried to cover so much history. And 90 minutes,
yeah,
which is next to impossible. And it's a really brisk pace. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really could have done a whole feature on, you know, Jerry Lawler or Jackie Fargo themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. But they cover a lot of ground in a short period of time, and it's just a fascinating story. Probably one of the most, if not the best, territory. You know, you can knock it for its gimmicks, and maybe it was a little too outrageous and over the top for some people's taste. I tend to think that wrestling worked best when it's actually kind of a parody of sport. Mm-hmm. But Memphis could do that too. They could do both. They could do the outrageous gimmicks. They could do the bloody feuds. But they also treated, you know, when the world champion came to down, they used the world champion very sparingly. They had Lawler knocking off contenders. You know, he would you know, come out and see that he's getting refocused on that. So Memphis had a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
So definitely one of the most interesting territories in the wrestling business.
Yeah, and we're thankful to you to be able to share those stories, and I always find them very fascinating, and, you know, as a connoisseur of wrestling history, definitely appreciate the work that you do.
And likewise, Jason. Good talking to you again.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we will talk to you again.
Let's be honest. Most wrestling websites suck. BS rumors, schoolyard gossip, plagiarism. It's no wonder why no one believes anything they read on the internet. Well, if you can't get something done right, you might as well do it yourself. Presenting the Fair to Flare Quarterly from the writers of fairtoflare.com and over a dozen other wrestling websites. We're not copy and pasting what we read in some newsletter. This is 100% original content from the best wrestling bloggers on the internet. In-depth analysis of the art of pro wrestling, debate, artwork, and humor. The Fair to Flare Quarterly will raise the bar of what wrestling journalism can and should be. Professionally edited and produced, and every contributor will be paid for their work. Order your copy of the Fair to Flare Quarterly today at fairtoflare.com. The better wrestling media has arrived.